Hello, and welcome to this week's Arab Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of The Digest. Arab Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It's our readers who support Arab Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. That's right, 2 months for free. In this world of information overload in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. With one article a day and the weekly podcast, we provide unique coverage of the Middle East and North Africa, featuring the very best experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Essential reading, essential listening, and no overload. My guest today is Tariq Megharissi. Tariq is a policy fellow with the North Africa and Middle East program at the ECFR, the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's a political analyst and researcher who specializes in North African affairs and politics, governance, and development in the Arab world. And he's a regular contributor to the podcast. Tariq, good to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me, as always, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is mine, Tariq. I want to begin by exploring how the Maghreb and Egypt are responding to the Gaza war, but what is your assessment? And is it fair to say that there's a clear split between the governments and how people on the streets are feeling?
Yeah, you kind of beat me to it, Bill. I was going to say, when you talk about Egypt and the Maghreb states, do you mean the states themselves or the populations they're in? And that there is a clear split, and we can go on to the states later on, but I want to talk about the people for a minute, because the people are the element of the equation that seems to always be left out of analysis. And you can see this kind of this deep rooted anxiety, agitation, unease from populations, not just because they have to sit down and watch what's happening in Gaza right now, but also that they can't do anything about it. You know, even in the countries where the leaderships are nominally pro-Palestinian, like Algeria or Tunisia, you don't want to go too far with the protesting, right? And so, yeah, there is this kind of deep-seated feeling of unease that is starting to bubble up in the more kind of tyrannical countries like Egypt. Even now, you see more and more protests that are kind of pushing the envelope and criticizing the Egyptian position therein, which is a very risky game for people to be playing. So you can see quite how high the feelings are. But I think that there's something deeper to it. You know, in Morocco or in Egypt, where the regimes are quite close to Israel, it's almost feeling like there's this disconnect between the people and their leadership. And they're not going to challenge them too far on this because they don't know where that rabbit hole leads. But that dissonance is real. And, you know, the people in Gaza were once something similar, right? They were the group of that doesn't quite fit in into the Israel-Palestinian model, and their very existence was a dissonance to it. And now look at what's happening to them. And I think if you look at every either oppressed population in the region, either writ large like the Egyptians, or the minorities like the Amazigh in various countries, or the Tebu, the tribes in the south, in Libya. I think every disenfranchised and oppressed group in the Middle East right now is looking at Gaza and is wondering if this is their future. You know, will they just be corralled and embattled and bloodied the second they become too much of a nuisance? And, you know, even on a larger scale, you know, how soon is it until the next time we have a protest movement in Tahrir Square or in Rabat or somewhere else? Are we going to start seeing things like these sniper drones being deployed to kind of get rid of protesters? You know, the kind of tech dystopia that's been unleashed on Gaza is kind of terrifying. And I can imagine that, you know, everybody knows that it's a much easier way to control people than to have to deploy an army where you don't know whether they're going to shoot or not shoot, or even side with the protesters, to know that you can now just do this by robot. And those kind of sniper drones, these little dogs, these announcement bots, It's all, yeah, the advertisement of a terrifying future. Sorry for going on a bit. Look.
No. And dystopian picture. And there's a sense, too, that, you know, what the Israelis are doing to Arabs in Gaza, as you suggest, this is a warning, in a sense. These authoritarian regimes can say, well, look, you know, when the Israelis were challenged, here's what they did, and don't you dare consider challenging us. I mean, I think about, you know, the hypocrisy of the West, which is absolutely correct, the way in which the West has responded to this war. But then I look at these authoritarian regimes and I think, what about the hypocrisy there?
Yeah, well, you know, the Arab regimes have been great at using the cause of Palestine for personal profit and propaganda for a long time. But, you know, actually, you can see elements of this now, which is kind of different to how it used to be still. You know, this is not kind of Abdel Nasser or Saddam Hussein or somebody like that talking about Palestinian rights to justify their lack of development at home, saying, you know, we have to fight this existential war, etc., etc. You have it slightly different. I mean, Qais Saied of Tunisia will do this to a certain extent, but I don't think it's quite as calculated. But look at Algeria as your paragon here. Now, Algeria is a self-defined revolutionary state with a very, very tight resonance with Palestine, with the Palestinian cause, for obvious anti-colonial reasons. They are the ones who are trying to lead the resolution at the Security Council now following the ICJ hearing. And yet you hear so little from them, because at the end of the day, you know, the Algerians are sitting in an uncomfortable position whereby they want to make better friends with Western European states, you know, create what the diplomats would call share equities and, you know, be able to manufacture things like helicopters and defense equipment together. And they're really looking at becoming closer to the United States. So now all of a sudden they have too much to lose to kind of go out on a limb and be very out front in support of the Palestinian cause. I think the others, I mean, and let's just call them the Abraham countries, right? You know, the Morocco all the way to the UAE. They're not even making any hypocritical stands or positions or statements. They're just waiting for this whole thing to blow over. You know, if you scratch the surface a bit, you can see the relationship is still great. You can see the security relationship is still great. Diplomatic ties are as strong as ever. They're really just, yeah, waiting for this all to blow over, which kind of harks back to what I said in response to the first question, which is just how pointless the Arab people are in the perceptions and the calculations of the Arab leaderships. They don't have to put on a song and dance for them like they did in the 1960s and 70s. Now they believe that they could just ignore them, and if they bubble up too much, they can simply just kill and arrest them. And isn't that just a sad state of affairs?
Well, let's look at Morocco. You mentioned that because the UAE, clearly, I mean, they've done a certain amount of virtue signaling, but their ties with the Israelis are as strong now as they were before the 7th of October. But what about Morocco and their ties with Israel? Are they in any way strained?
I mean, from a popular level, perhaps, but I think the Moroccan case and the Moroccan relationship is kind of different to the Emiratis. You know, they're a bit more sophisticated at how they do this. They're a bit more mature. The relationship is a bit more mature because you have this big Jewish community in Morocco for a long time. So, you know, you can see discontent on the Israeli side saying, look, you know, we just did the Abraham agreements, we recognized the Western Sahara, and you barely made a peep after October 7th. We wanted, you know, a stronger statement of condemnation from you. And from the Moroccan side, at least on the official level, you can say, well, you know, they don't believe that the Israelis have gone about this in the right way whatsoever. But like with the Emiratis, the relationship as a whole is considered too important for them to consign to the dustbin right here. You know, the Israelis have been vital in pumping foreign exchange into Morocco, although there is some discontent on the agricultural side there. They have been vital in upgrading and enhancing Morocco's defense capabilities. And that defense relationship is going to keep getting closer. And then there is just this kind of overall alliance, you know, which Israel is included in. And if you look at Morocco's interest in the Sahel, and that runs up with the UAE. And again, we see these connecting dots that it is an Abraham alliance. It's not just about bilateral relationships here. So, you know, you're either in the group or you're not. And I think in their case, they would much rather be in the group. So yes, you have discontent from the people in Morocco. You can see Palestinian flags here and there, and when you go out in the streets, which is not the same case as you would in Abu Dhabi or in Dubai. But yeah, it's kind of bigger than Gaza, I guess, is the response you would get from an honest official.
So those links with the Israelis are what, much more important than the Palestinian cause?
I think if you ask the leadership, they would say yes. I mean, the Palestinian cause is tired. But, you know, let's qualify this a bit, because if you look at the actions of these states, and let's not just single out the Moroccans, let's look at the Abraham group here. If you look at the actions of these states, then yes, you would say that they have zero interest in the Palestinian cause, because on a working level, they are as tight with the Israelis as possible. There is no clear leverage being used against them. Even the threat of leverage at the OIC Arab League joint meeting held by the Saudis months ago now was torpedoed by these same countries. But on a talking level, they retain interest in the Palestinian cause. And, you know, you have this kind of Arab peace plan, which is trying to change the conversation by focusing Israelis on the day after in Gaza, saying, I know you will think, you know, to the Israelis that the Jordanians or the Egyptians or one of us can just come in and control the ground in Gaza for you afterwards. But we're not going to do it. We're not going to clean up your mess. We want a 24-month roadmap towards a Palestinian state, something that's credible here enough with this kind of, you know, this fugue state that the Palestinians have been in since the Oslo agreements were signed. But you don't know how credible that is, how they can even make it happen, especially when the Israelis keep creating the facts on the ground that they are creating. You know, is there even going to be a Gaza left to manage in the aftermath? Or is it just going to be a new Israeli spree of settlements and a few Palestinian tent cities and the towns once known as Khan Yunis and Rafah?
Yeah, and of course, yeah, daily we see the evidence in social media of the atrocities being committed by the IDF. And as much as governments of these states may want to tamp down any popular support, the fact is people are seeing this as we are seeing it day in, day out. But look, let me ask you, Tarek, taking everything that you've said thus far, is there any possibility, and I'm going to set aside Egypt for the moment, but is there any possibility that the Maghreb states could just come together and present a united front in regards to the Gaza war and what happens when the war is ended? Or is that a bit of a pipe dream?
Yeah, I unfortunately do think it's a bit of a pipe dream. But, you know, when you were kind of introducing the question, you said everybody can see what the IDF is doing on a daily basis. And I think for a lot of the leaderships or a lot of the pettier warlords who don't quite make the level of leadership like Haftar in Libya, they love it. They love the fact that, you know, the emperor has no clothes, that the most horrific and gruesome things you could ever see are being broadcast daily from a Western ally with the full support of the United States, United Kingdom, and Germany and other leading human rights commentators. Because now they know that they are free to do whatever they want. And so for them, that part in particular is a really ominous boon. But in terms of the states working together, I mean, every single conference on the Maghreb region will open with the line that the Maghreb region is the least interconnected region on the planet. And so there is no kind of unity between states. I mean, even if you break them down, the Algerians and the Moroccans have this kind of petty pantomime rivalry, which is right now at a peak. Tunisia is kind of deeply mired in its own problems. And President Kais Saied seems to believe that the Palestinians aren't quite fervent enough and towards the Palestinian cause and that he can do it better than them. And Libya is divided as it has always been divided. So when you have such broken countries and such a broken region, they cannot really stand together to to create common positions of this kind? And then, I mean, lastly, what could they even do in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian file? You know, the closest relationships in the region are with the Jordanians and the Egyptians, between Israel and Palestine, shortly followed up by the Saudis and the Emiratis, who kind of finance and bankroll a lot of these. The Qataris, by trying to help, have almost isolated themselves from that picture. And so, yeah, it's not only that they're not able to do anything, but I think to look to them to be the kind of heroes here would be misguided, because they're not the ones with any sticks or carrots to be able to play.
Okay, you've shattered that illusion for me, but necessarily so.
That's what I do.
I'd set Egypt aside, but let us now move to Egypt. Is President Sisi caught between a rock and a hard place? And if so, how will he play things moving forward?
I think he's kind of happy right now. Perhaps slightly ignorantly so. But, you know, with this recent deal with the Emiratis, he's getting the cash injection that he so desperately needed. It's unlocking further IMF money without some of the trickier conditionality that the IMF were previously pushing for in terms of reeling in the dominance of the military, who have kind of cannibalized the economy, especially since 2014. So economically, he's in a much more comfortable place. There is a ticking time bomb that he sits on, which is the fact that, you know, the Egyptian pound is devaluing at a horrendous rate. It looks now, with the recent devaluation, that it's not been a free float or a full float, but it's really, they're setting a new peg, which is dangerous, not just because, you know, you don't know where the bottom is in terms of the currency and for the local population, but then you create these new divides in the society because you start having these dual exchange rates between a black market rate and an official rate. And we've seen in Libya the massive damage that this can cause. And so since maybe November of last year, you know, life in Egypt has gotten orders of magnitude worse, and bless them, the Egyptian people have really put up with a lot previously. You know, there is massive poverty in that country, but then to see it get orders of magnitude worse, again, there's a question mark over where this all may lead. And then there's the quiet idea that the Egyptians are preparing to receive tens of thousands of Gazans in these new camps that they are creating, and this is going to inflame the situation with the tribes of the Sinai. And of course, you know, Egypt has been fighting a war, a counter-terrorism operation, whatever you want to call it, in the Sinai region for decades now. And you know, they do rely on these kind of relationships and these promises with the local Bedouin tribes, and this will be seen as a betrayal of that. And so potentially the situation in the Sinai could get considerably more dangerous, which is another headache on Sisi. But I think for now, he's not even looking at these things. And again, the kind of theme of this podcast that's emerging is that leaders don't have to care what their people think anymore. And so I genuinely think that he's not caring so much about that. And he's kind of happy because he got his deus ex machina. And as you know, any Egyptian will tell you, when time gets too tough, Egypt is too big to fail. And that story and that message just got reinforced for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
Yeah, this big contribution from the Emiratis, Ras Al Hikma, and also the IMF, then coming in right behind to I think it was double what the amount that they're prepared to give to the Sisi regime. And you make a very interesting point about the inflation and also what's happening, the devaluation, and it is the Egyptian people who are paying this extraordinary price, while the military, as you said, cannibalizes the economy. And it seems that both the IMF and the Emiratis are no longer even attempting to encourage Sisi to demilitarize. But there we are. You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and the North Africa specialist, Terek Megharisi. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East and North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One article a day and the weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Check us out on ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. Let me ask you about an area I know you've spent a lot of time working on. And really, you mentioned that the thought that Palestinians could be pushed out of Gaza into North Sinai. But the war could exacerbate what is already a desperate migration crisis. So let's look at that crisis and how Europe is managing, or should I say not managing it, because you've just co-authored a paper for ECFR with the title Road to Nowhere, Why Europe's Border Externalization is a Dead End.
Yeah, thank you for the plug for the paper. I do appreciate that. And also, you know, it's not just the Palestinians or the Gazans fleeing themselves that might now exacerbate this crisis. It's the economic and political impacts that we've just been talking about. I mean, when it comes to Egypt, we didn't even mention the fact that, you know, the receipts from the Suez Canal have dried up since October and since the Houthi blockade. And the real reason why Egypt is too big to fail is because the deepest, darkest nightmares of right-wing Europe is that 100 million Egyptians could start, you know, wondering whether they should be crossing the Mediterranean or not. And, you know, across the region, life seems to be getting bleaker. Maybe not always economically worse, but certainly bleaker. And the populations feel like they have no choice but to migrate. And then throw in the kind of ring of catastrophes around the Maghreb region, Sudan, Chad, Mali, going deeper to West African and East African conflicts. And we do have a situation whereby those looking to migrate and those who are seeking safe refuge are increasing almost exponentially. And the lesson of the last 10 years of European migration management is that these kind of twin tools that the Europeans rely upon of externalization, so trying to push your borders out to North Africa, and securitization, treating migrants and migration as something of a security threat rather than, let's say, an economic opportunity, as has been done throughout history. We are making this problem worse because we are not solving the problem. We are trying to half bury our heads in the problem, half make it someone else's. And I think the Europeans have managed to convince themselves over the last 6 years or so that, you know what, externalization does work. We signed these deals with the Libyans, we signed the deals with the Tunisians, with the Moroccans, with the Turks, and numbers went down. But, you know, the numbers arriving went down. The numbers who were leaving or the numbers who are migrating did not go down. So really what we've done is we've made the Mediterranean a much more deadly place. We've made the route of migrants through places like Libya a much more dangerous place where, you know, with European money, Libyan groups and militias who, you know, one day were people smuggling gangs and now we're supposed to believe that they are counter smuggling law enforcement are kind of rounding up migrants. They are torturing them for their money. You know, there's all kinds of horrific abuses going on. And then when they finally send them off on the Mediterranean, they call their mates in the Coast Guard and they capture them and they put them round and round in the cycle until they get out. And finally, the Europeans have created a model whereby every budding dictator or cash-strapped ruler in the region will now seek to use migration as a lever on the Europeans to get some money, to get some security assistance and so on. And we see this today, most notably with Khalifa Haftar in eastern Libya. And, you know, the biggest catastrophe of the last 12 months, that ship that sank off the coast of Greece, that was one that disembarked from Libya. And they are using it now to try to, you know, strengthen their ties with the Europeans. And similarly, and he's done it par excellence, is Qais Saeed, where the Italians and those on the front lines will say, you know, Saeed does want to help us to stop migration. And really, it's been the vector for him to ride towards full normalization, towards a kind of blank check to be free to commit any abuses that he will commit. And also to still get European money and financing and security assistance despite breaking every human rights rule in the book and despite refusing to sign up to an IMF agreement that can guarantee some kind of, you know, proper economic management for all of this money so that it's not just a black hole for for European money. So I guess that sums up the title of why it's a road to nowhere. We do have opportunities to improve it. But yes, you know, last year, I think there were 130,000 people who crossed, which is very, very close to the migration crisis levels of 2014, 15, 16. And this year might just be the year that we create new records. So migration is a big issue, something that will be front and center. And I think for the sake of the poor people who are migrating and for the health of European politics, because this is very much an engine which is driving Europe further and further to the right, because, you know, Europeans keep putting out these externalization plans and talking about migration as a security threat and getting populations scared and hysterical whilst being unable to solve the problem. So unless we can start putting forward competent solutions and trying to change our perspective on the situation, this is only going to keep getting worse and worse for migrants, for Maghreb states, and for the Europeans.
Yeah, aptly titled A Road to Nowhere. Look, you are a Libya expert, of course. So let's have a closer look at what is happening in Libya on the political front. Are outside players still dominating the landscape? You mentioned Haftar, and of course Haftar is tied very tightly with the UAE, but what is the situation right now in Libya, Tarek?
Yeah, I always rankle at the term expert, to be honest. So I'm someone who's had the misfortune of following things very closely for a very long period of time now. And yes, I think outside powers are just as involved as they ever have been. I mean, the state of Libya is pretty similar to, I think, the last few times that we've talked on the topic now. You have a divided country. You have two highly venal leaderships, with the Dabeiba family controlling Western Libya and the more official government, and the Haftar family controlling Eastern Libya. A bit less government, a bit more mafia style, but there isn't that much daylight between the two in terms of their positions, their lack of interest in governing, their capital extraction or the kleptocracies that they have set up to kind of suck Libya dry of revenue. And so the situation on the ground is of that of a slowly rotting state. Again, the perspectives of the population is largely bleak because they don't see where the change they were once promised is coming from. They've stopped believing in it entirely. And life is getting harder and harder. Prices of basic goods are going up. Right now, you have kind of a standoff between the central bank governor and Prime Minister Dabeiba to try to, I mean, at least ostensibly on the surface, the disagreement and the argument is about trying to rein in the prime minister's spending and to establish a budget of some kind in order to order Libya's finances. But, you know, really, this is an extension of what I think we discussed last time, which was the crude for fuel swap program that is going on, which is kind of secretly funding everything that the Dabeibas and the Haftars do, where in a situation which is allegedly handily brokered by the Emiratis, Libya will trade a certain amount of crude oil at an undisclosed, untransparent price in order to receive a certain amount of refined fuels at an undisclosed price and with an undisclosed brokerage fee. So Libya's entire wealth, because 98% of the country's revenue does come from crude sales, is now being bartered through a black box system, basically. And we don't know how much or who really is profiting from it. So the only ones that are really happy these days in Libya are, I think, the foreign states who are there and who are there on the ground. You know, the Emiratis have these great ties with both the Dabeibas and the Haftars. They straddle the two. I think their ideological, political goals in Libya were satisfied by how things have ended up since the end of the war. Economically, they are, you know, well entrenched, as you can see in the oil network and in using Libya to fund and assist and to be a logistical hub for their other escapades in the region, like in Sudan. And so they remain highly involved and highly influential, I think overall to the detriment of Libya, but I'll leave that to others to argue. Similarly, on the eastern Libyan side, you have the Russians, and the Russians are just entrenching further and further, you know, since the coincidentally had the death of Evgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group. The Wagner deployment and equities in Libya have been moved over to the defense ministry, so they've become more official. The deputy defense minister has visited eastern Libya numerous times. They even helped in the oppressive response to the tragedy in Derna last September. They helped to shut down the situation and to basically keep the Haftars insulated. We see, you know, newer Russian equipment, Russian tanks. I think they were T-72s in Benghazi. The MiGs that are deployed there are getting refitted. There are discussions about the Russians taking on a lease for part of the port of Tobruk. And this is in addition to the kind of three air bases which they already control. So that's actually rising in a dangerous way. And again, it's being used to fuel the conflict in Sudan, the air entry into Chad, into Mali, and a lot of illicit practices that are going on. You know, Bloomberg did a great expose recently on how up to $5 billion in Russian fuel is being smuggled into European markets through Libya and then Albania. You have the drug trade of Captagon from Syria. You have the people that are being smuggled and trafficked through. We just talked about the Pylos disaster. That is also a product of what the Russians are doing through with the Haftars. And if I'm not going on for too long, let me just sum up by talking about the Turks, because the Turks are still sitting pretty, the ones in real control in Western Libya, and so by extension, Libya writ large. I think they must be the only country that gets paid for their colonization of another country, in the sense that their troops and their presence in Libya is being paid for by the Libyan government. They are reaching out to eastern Libya, and over the last 12 to 18 months, they have made real economic pathways. So they are still kind of the kingmaker on the ground, and the one who is profiting the most from Dabeiba's profligacy and the direction that the country is going in. And I think that the strength of foreign actors in Libya can be summed up kind of anecdotally by the fact that, you know, the broader political class who is kind of fed up with the Dabeiba family and this government and how they are ruining the country, you know, their hope for a future government is not to go through the UN, is not to go through any political process. It's to get the blessings of the Egyptians and the Turks to co-guarantee a government between them, with the hopes that, you know, that would provide enough weight and inertia to protect any new Libyan government that would come in, and to get them into Tripoli, where previous governments have failed. So that shows you the real importance of foreign states and the absolute control they retain over Libya's political, economic and security spaces up to today.
Yeah, that's very interesting. As you say, the Turks being paid to colonize Libya, it's all quite bleak. But look, compared to what is happening right now in the Levant, of course, there's the war, but there's Syria, there's a possibility of a full-scale Israeli invasion in Lebanon to deal with Hezbollah. Jordan is in a tight place economically and politically. North Africa seems, what, relatively stable. Is this the calm before a storm, Derek?
You don't know exactly when the storm will coming. All we can do is read variables and say that the region is not in a good place. But I'd also say that the region is interconnected. I mean, look at the ties between Bashar al-Assad and Haftar, for example. What happens in Syria echoes in Libya afterwards, just as how the revolution of Libya echoed in Syria in the first place. The economy in Jordan is squeezed for the same reason that the economies of Egypt, Libya and Tunisia are squeezed. And yes, you know, kind of every country in the region has its own problems. But just as a rising tide kind of raises all ships, I think the broader political and economic situation in the region, especially as the kind of region tries to resettle into this new order of the Abraham States, is causing a lot of disruption, a lot of despair and a lot of destitution. We also have the kind of ripple effects of, you know, most people don't include Sudan as part of North Africa. I like to, because I think culturally it's there. And so we have the impact of that horrific war and how it will spread into Chad and elsewhere. and how this kind of dispute in the Sahel between the Moroccan Emirati Russian group on one side and the Algerians on the other side may also inflame Mali. The oil countries of Libya and Algeria might boast higher than ever, or very good state revenues right now, but the situation at a market level is not great. And that's mainly due to another common problem across the region, which is these kind of small group of elite families who kind of dominate the national economy and they dominate the markets. And it's almost like a death knell for any country's economy because they slowly strangle any free enterprise. And it means that the private sector is unable to be the wealth generating engine that the countries kind of need. Even in the kind of best country in the region, which is Morocco, and I say best country in the sense that it seems to be the healthiest economically, it seems to be the healthiest politically, where you had these, big elections where there was a big change from a left-wing Islamist groups to more right-wing technocrats without much of a hiccup. They have all of these mega projects going on. The mood there is really buoyant, which is very different to elsewhere in the region. But even there, you have this kind of ominous backdrop of 5 years of one of the worst droughts in Morocco's history, taking, I think, 300,000 jobs from the agricultural sector every year. And that climate change is kind of a big cloud on the horizon. And so all the region is interconnected. Morocco's buoyancy today depends on the buoyancy of that Abraham's group, because, there is Emirati investments coming into their activities in the Sahel and so on and so forth. So I think because the health of the overall region is bad, we can't say that the Maghreb is in any better place. It's just kind of waiting for that storm to hit the Maghreb, because all the region is tied together. And unfortunately, it looks right now that all the region is sinking together.
Mm. Okay, well, listen, we will we'll leave it there on a rather somber note. As you say, the storm is brewing. And these governments are really disconnected in lots of ways from the people that they rule over. We will have to wait and see in this very tumultuous year of 2024 what happens next. But in the meantime, I thank you very much once again, Derek, for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill. I always enjoy these conversations, even though the substance might be getting more and more depressing over the years. But thank you again for the platform and the conversation.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was the North Africa specialist, Derek Megharisi. You'll have noticed that we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free 2-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators and writers, contributors like Terek. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn, and search our library of over 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thanks for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest, essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.